Melissa, you recently published a piece in The Conversation, which describes a way forward for the church in the face of all the sex abuse scandal and its fallout. But before we get into it, can you set the stage for us? Like, what happened with the church and what are the consequences? What's the church grappling with right now?
I think I should start by saying the sex abuse scandal has been a major issue in the church since, depending on how you calculate it, at least 2002. But I should also say that sociologically, I think there are more structural problems in relationship to the church than can be attributed just to the sex abuse scandal. So retention is really bad for those raised in the church these days in the United States and many other countries. Attendance has been dropping for at least the last 20 years. Priestly vocations are way down, meaning people who are willing to enter the priesthood. There are a lot of signs of strain and resistance and just disaffiliation when it comes to people being raised Catholic. The United States would be showing a decline in Catholic affiliation if it wasn't for Latino immigration.
Just Latino or Latino and Asian? Because I feel like, at least in LA, you know, half the pews are Filipino.
Asian as well, but I think in terms of the overall sure. numbers, the Latino immigration sure. is much bigger. And keeping the American Catholic population at about 25% of the overall American population, give or take a couple percentage points. So I guess the point I was making in the conversation piece is just that I found a lot of the news coverage to be focused on the nuts and bolts of what could be changed in relationship to canon law. What did Francis know? Did other people know things? You know, what could be done differently? Without a big picture sense of how change actually happens in the church. Mm-hmm. And so I decided that it was important to intervene as someone who studied the last Vatican Council, Vatican II, about how change happens in the church and what change, real change, could look like and the advantages of a council vis-a-vis all of the other proposals that have been put forth by, you know, both people inside and outside of the church.
For those of us who aren't familiar with the, you know, history or workings of the Catholic Church, what is Vatican II?
Mm-hmm. Vatican II was the second Vatican Council in the Roman Catholic Church. So it was an ecumenical council, which technically means all of the leaders of the world church are invited to come and convene together. That includes heads of religious orders, heads of dioceses. At the time of Vatican II, which was 1962 to 1965, there were about 2,500 bishops and theologians and heads of religious orders that participated. Today, that number would be about double that. So it would be about 5,000 members of the hierarchy would be kind of the easiest way to say it. And the idea is that they get together, they discuss usually drafts of documents that are written by experts and then vote on whether to ratify those documents.
Is it like sort of a constitutional convention, but for the church?
Yes, pretty much. And it's the idea is to, so when John the 23rd called Vatican II in 1958, he said he just felt like he needed to open some windows. He needed to let in some fresh air. And that was really his agenda. And of course it completely freaked out the folks in the Vatican who wanted to keep the windows shut. And they spent the next 4 years trying to make sure that the council would actually do nothing, which ended up not being the case. Vatican II ended up reforming all kinds of aspects of the church, both practically, doctrinally, and just in terms of its overall orientation toward the modern world. And that's because I argue in my book on Vatican II that that was a result of progressive bishops organizing early, immediately, and rejecting the documents that were the preparatory documents that were drawn up by the Roman Curia, basically seizing a political opportunity and saying that this was not going to be a rubber stamp of the Curia's views.
Interesting. So it was sort of like a democratization of of church law, like an opportunity to have a more democratic process. To
right.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say democratization, right? It was more oligarchy, right? I mean, if you think of like what are the classic forms of political organization, there's monarchy, oligarchy, and democracy. And historically, most regimes are oligarchies. And that was true of the early church before the formation of the papacy.
Yeah.
And these types of church councils were common and important in like the fourth century.
Right. So. But once you get to 2,500 oligarchs, right, voting, it, I think it's a little bit more complicated.
But I mean, they're not parish priests. They're not the laity.
Right.
You know, so it's like, you know, the Hungarian diet before the First World War or something like that.
Right. But the idea is, but I think the other important thing to emphasize is that it was, it's not really a democracy in the sense that majority rules. Majority does rule, but for the most part of the 400 or so votes that were taken over the course of the council, there were probably only 10 that were, that had enough variation in them for me to bother explaining, for example, or that were divisive enough to be useful sociologically. So the pressure is to put documents forward through a process of revision until they're really sure that there's going to be consensus. So it's not quite the same as our, for example, divisive political system. There's a deep belief, a deep religious belief in the fact that if the bishops are divided, then there's something wrong. Huh. Right? Something needs to be fixed.
And what do you think might occur? So I understood your piece is saying, look at what happened at Vatican II. Maybe this is the type of mechanism that the church can confront the sex scandals.
Well, I think what I was trying to get through was the idea that I think the sex scandal is horrific in relationship to the, you know, the actual scandal and what happened to the people who were abused. But it's also, I think, symbolic for many Catholics in terms of a lot of the issues they have with the church in general, that it's hierarchical, that it's not transparent, that decisions don't get made in any way, shape, or form in quickly or in relationship to the laity, right? And so I think that actually focusing on little aspects of canon law that need to be changed or who knew what when is, you know, lacks the big picture, which is that the church needs to have a discussion about the nature of the priesthood. Does it make sense to have celibate male only priests? Does it make sense to say that? And this, there are a lot of other issues. So what I found out about Vatican II is that the key driving force about what explains why some reforms passed and others failed had to do with where the pressures for legitimacy lie. And so I think thinking about what issues of legitimacy are facing the church today, it has to do with the sex abuse scandal for sure. But, you know, but also that extends to what is a legitimate priesthood and, also issues about, is it legitimate to tell 98% of practicing Catholics who use or have used artificial means of contraception, meaning anything besides the rhythm method, that they are in, you know, that they are sinning. That also, it's a legitimacy issue saying that you can't use condoms to prevent AIDS in Africa. There are a lot of issues facing the church that I think need to be discussed.
So it's interesting that you brought up all those issues, because I view this, I mean, you talked about the Vatican Council as being like a, you know, like your classic social movement story of there's an opportunity. And then, you know, the organized faction seizes on the opportunity. You know, in some ways, this strikes me as like, you know, your garbage can model type deal where you have a problem. And so people realize that they can't do it. And then what solutions do people propose to this problem? It's what they were proposing all along, right? It's not like here's this problem that comes along and people say like, oh, well, here's a, you know, I'd never thought of this before. And if you ask me 2 weeks ago, I would have disliked this idea. But in response to this problem, it seems like this is the most practical solution. To the contrary, it's like, well, the kind of people who wanted to have married priests, you know, were saying, you know what would solve this? Married priests. And the kind of people who, you know, want to make sure nobody's having sex in seminary are saying, you know what would solve this? Making sure nobody's having sex in seminary. So, you know, and that was actually kind of... that's kind of the reason I'm pessimistic that anything will happen, because almost immediately after this happened, especially after the Vagano letter. And just for background, I mean, Melissa knows this, but any listeners who don't, Vagano was the Pope's ambassador to the United States under Pope Benedict, and I think also under the tail end of Pope John Paul. And he basically wrote this letter about 2 months ago, I think in early August, saying that everybody knew that McCarrick was sexually harassing seminarians. Pope Benedict had silenced him, basically sent him to kind of informal priest jail. And then Francis let him out because he needed political allies. And so both Vagano's letter, which was explicitly political, not political, you know, Republican, Democrat type sense, but political within the church. He was explicitly saying there's this faction of progressives, most of whom are gay, who are organizing, you know, and they don't really care if people are misbehaving as long as they're political allies, you know, right. And we need to basically get rid of all these people who are, you know, not taking the abuse seriously and didn't care because they need the political allies, or, you know, as long as you agree with them, they'll let you do whatever you want. And then so you saw kind of the progressive faction reacting against that and saying, this is just like a frame job. And, you know, it's all about trying to get the Pope by the conservative faction, you know, and this is kind of like the revenge of Benedict's faction against Francis's faction, and like saying like, oh, well, you know, Vagano's just mad because he was passed over for a promotion at some point or something like that. Like basically it's personal ambition, et cetera.
Was the Vagano letter a really extraordinary thing to see sort of elites openly oppose each other? Or is that something that happens from time to time in the church?
Melissa would know better than I would, but everybody I knew was shocked by it. Like we're using words like unprecedented.
Well, that's why I think a council is something that even people who are ready for change in the church would be hesitant to do, because that's when the factions become more clear, right? Because when you force people to have conversations, right, then their disagreements become more apparent. But I would say, with the exception of councils, yes, this letter was, extraordinary. Yeah.
And also just clarifying things is contrary to Francis's style. Francis's whole papacy has been defined by affirming existing rules in principle, but allowing exceptions and to them in practice. You know, I mean, this is sometimes called like pastoral, pastoral approach. The idea of saying like, well, we're not going to formally reject this rule we used to have, but, you know, in the interests of individual cases, we'll allow more case by case exemptions to it.
No, it's interesting. It's somewhat reminiscent of like what state breakdown theory says happens right before the institution of the state falls apart, right? Like the people at the top start turning on each other.
Yeah.
And I like this idea. It's like an institutional refresh almost.
I did send a copy of my book to Pope Francis, so.
Oh. So once he opens his mail, we'll be seeing big changes.
I sent it upon his election, so okay. I'm doubtful that it ever got to him, unfortunately. But
the one thing that I really loved about your piece, not just because it's like a really interesting subject and you're clearly a good storyteller, I love how it's a great example of pragmatic qualitative work, right? How you can take historical work and still really be the kind of type of problem-solving oriented sociology that Monica Prasad was talking about earlier this season, right? It's like rigorous and pragmatic, but it still gives us sort of guideposts to help solve practical problems. So I thought that was really cool.
Thank you. I would have to say that I think that that would be a result of the fact that I always focus on explanation, right? Trying to figure out, even if it's qualitative, trying to answer clear questions, like what explains why some reforms passed and others failed.
Yeah, so this is some way it's an issue of like the clarity thing. This isn't so much about like conciliar matters or anything like that, but just how the scandal developed. What I think is really interesting about it is there was a long period where, so like when the McCarrick thing came out,
very quickly, who's McCarrick for people who don't know?
McCarrick was a cardinal. And I think he was in Philadelphia, and then he was in D.C., and then he was succeeded by Cardinal Wuerl. in DC.
Right.
And Wuerl had a reputation for being tough on sex abuse, which is relevant to what I'll tell you in a second. So McCarrick, it came out this summer that he, over a period of, I don't know, 6 years or something like that, had abused a boy who was actually the first boy he'd ever baptized. And he had this boy referred to him as Uncle Ted, and he started abusing him at about the age of 12 and then continued to abuse him all through his teen years. And then when that happened, Pope Francis almost immediately sent him to priest jail. I mean, the technical phrase that they use is, invite to a life of quiet reflection. But basically it means go to a monastery, shut up, and never let anybody hear you again. It's priest jail. So, and so, for instance, another case that we saw that is Benedict, one of Benedict's very first acts as Pope was he took Maciel, who was this notorious Mexican priest, and he sent him to priest jail. And Maciel had done all sorts of horrible things, but I don't want to get him wrong. But just check the Wikipedia page. It's pretty ugly. And also something that Maciel and McCarrick had in common is that they were both great fundraisers, which is why they were able to get away with this stuff for so long, is that, you know, if you wanted access to the money they control through their foundations or something like that, you kind of didn't want to ask questions about the sketchy things they were doing in their personal lives.
Parenthetically, just reinforcing my view that religion and the academy are two very similar lines of business. But anyhow, go on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So-and-so's a foundation officer. Don't ask what he does with his grad students.
All right.
So, anyway, so this came out about McCarrick, and he was out, like, immediately once that came out. But then, you know, what Vigano, and then almost simultaneously with McCarrick being out, the Attorney General of Pennsylvania issued a huge report documenting basically every sex abuse case involving a Catholic priest in the state of Pennsylvania in the last 100 years. And there were a lot of them. And, you know, it's not like people didn't know that there hadn't been a, it's not like people were unaware that there had been an abuse crisis, but just the sheer scale and also the sheer graphicness. So for instance, there were, one of the stories in the Pennsylvania report was that there were a couple of priests who, there was like a gang of priests who would have boys that they were grooming carry special colored rosaries or something like that so that other priests could recognize them as ones they were grooming. There was another story about a couple of priests who had who jointly mock crucified a boy and like raped him in like a mockery of a mass. I mean, it wasn't just abuse. It was like
all right,
grotesque, you know? And I mean, not that abuse isn't grotesque, but it was like super grotesque. So that comes out at basically the same time as the McCarrick thing this summer. And that offends people. And it was pretty dispiriting. And then the Vigano letter comes out, and Vigano says, look, nobody knew that McCarrick had abused a child until right now. And then once he did, he was out immediately. But everybody knew that he was sexually harassing seminarians for decades. And this was common knowledge. And nobody was unaware of this. And everybody knew that he would, you know, force seminarians to go to his beach house and always make sure that there was like they were short one bed. So somebody had to sleep in his bed and that sort of thing. And there's been public testimony from seminarians who were sexually harassed like this, many of whom ended up giving up their vocations as a result. So and then the response from the hierarchy, especially the progressive faction, has basically been, yeah, right. As soon as we found out that he was abusing kids, he was out. And then kind of the scandal is, yeah, but you knew he was sexually harassing seminarians. And it's like, right, as soon as he abused kids, he was out. It's like, no, you're not hearing me. You knew he was abusing right. seminarians and you didn't care. It's like, yeah, as soon as we found out he did something wrong with someone under 18, he was out. It's like, you don't get right. it, you know? So, and, you know, the story about the seminarians is very similar to like the Harvey Weinstein stories, you know, in that you have someone who was very powerful who was sexually harassing adults and everybody else kind of ignored it and looked the other way because they figured like, oh, it's consenting adults, whatever. And they weren't thinking of it as sexual harassment. You know, although, you know, there's a difference in that in Hollywood, you know, people are free to have their personal lives, but these are theoretically celibate clergy. So even if it was consensual, it still would have been against canon law. So there was this weird disconnect where the hierarchy, especially the progressive faction, just like couldn't understand, because they just had this idea that the only thing people care about is abuse of children. And so when people were complaining,
they missed
this isn't the same issue. And so you'd hear these things of saying like, yeah, we solved that problem already in 2002 with the Dallas rules, which is what Melissa was alluding to earlier. There was a big conference of all the bishops in the United States in Dallas, and they wrote rules which have actually been extremely effective. There's been basically zero, like something like less than a dozen per year new abuse allegations since 2002. So the rules that they wrote in 2002 have been extremely effective. But they're basically like, yeah, we take kids seriously, and we've done that ever since. We've taken them seriously ever since 2002. But they don't. It took them a very long time to get that people were offended by the idea of sexually harassing seminarians or other misconduct that involves adults.
Yeah, and I think that's really comes back full circle to the point of the whole piece that, you know, why I bothered to write it was because I think in a council, part of the call, part of the agenda is supposed to be to listen, to figure out what people are seeing as issues, right? And the issues will vary from, you know, parts of the world, from country to country. And so, you know, that's why I think a much broader conversation needs to happen. It's far beyond kind of the exact rules about how abuse is reported and what is considered abuse, right? It's about kind of the nature of power and authority.
It's interesting that you said there's differences in how it works by region. I think that's true. There's also similarities. So almost simultaneously with the Pennsylvania thing and the McCarrick thing, there was a scandal in Honduras where there was a love triangle among seminarians in a Honduras seminary, and one of the seminarians killed himself as a result of the love triangle. And then, you know, a large number of the other seminarians petitioned the bishops to basically investigate the seminary and make sure that, you know, their fellow seminarians weren't having sex. And the bishops basically just said, this is nothing. And so it was very similar to the McCarrick story. But it was happening in Latin America. All the Chilean bishops resigned. I'm not sure the details of that. But but to agree with you, right, there are places where it's different in that there have been abuse scandals in Africa. But as a rule, the African scandals are heterosexual, where, in America, conservative Catholics very often look to the African church and think of it as more conservative. But it's not actually more chaste. It's just more heterosexual. And, you know, the things that happen in Africa are like the kind of things you used to read in like Victorian era pamphlets about priests sexually harassing nuns. But those actually happen in the African church. I mean, they happen a little bit in the American church, but not nearly on the same scale. Apparently it's fairly pervasive that, you know, when a young woman thinks she has a vocation to be a nun and asks for a letter of recommendation from her parish priest will sexually harass her to give her the letter.
Oh, just like the Academy. Final points to make on this one?
Well, I just say, given that, you know, Melissa's an expert on the church politics, I'm going to ask her the totally unfair question, which I will be too charitable to go back and revisit in 5 years and show her the answer to. Do you think anything will happen, right? Do you think we'll get another set of Dallas rules that say this will apply to adults too? Or do you think this will just get hopelessly bogged down in church politics and nothing will happen? Or what do you think will happen?
That's a great question. I think it'll be very easy for them to put forward some sort of document that emphasizes the importance of celibacy, right? Mm-hmm. That's within their wheelhouse. That's what they're focused on right now. And so they don't have to go too far down the road of what is sexual harassment, right? I mean, there's no way the church could handle that because academia can't handle that yet. When is it sexual harassment? When is it simply abuse of power? And if the academy cannot address that, there's no way that the Roman Catholic Church is ready to address that issue.
Yeah.
But I do think they'll probably do something about the fact that, you know, all of these people are supposed to be taking, it's a time of contemplation and reflection, and they're either about to take vows of celibacy or already have. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that they'll probably focus on that.